from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sitting at the very heart of Africa, Congo is home to riches and wrenching violence on a grand scale. More than 3 million people have been killed in 5 years of tangled civil war. But Congo's gold is still flowing, its diamonds still twinkle, and its coltan embedded in your cell phone is still selling at $350 a pound. The UN's Congo presence is so tame that peacekeepers are derided as dangerous tourists, and the killing continues. Tonight on Point, Congo's hell and the world's responsibility. We begin in the northeast Congolese province of Ituri, a mineral-rich region that is the bloodiest corner of a terrible war. The fighting feeds on a web of rival ethnic militia movements and shifting alliances involving nine of Congo's neighboring countries at one time or another, Uganda, Rwanda, Zimbabwe, and more. UN peacekeeping troops have been vastly outnumbered and outgunned. French troops have only recently gained control in one town. Jason Beaubien is Africa correspondent for NPR News. I asked him about the extent of the fighting in Bunia, Ituri province.
The level of fighting has escalated to a point where people can't stay in their homes. And Bunia is an example to an extreme of what's been happening all over eastern Congo. Eastern Congo is no longer controlled by Kinshasa, the central government in Congo. There's really very little contact between the central government and about 20 different rebel groups that control different parts of eastern Congo. And in Bunia, you had two different rebel groups fighting it out for control of the town. And in the process, almost all of the people fled their homes, either to leave Bunia altogether and go to refugee camps much further south or to the north, or they fled to two UN compounds in Bunia, one at the airport and another one which was the MONUC headquarters, the UN mission for the Congo, and essentially were camped out in the backyard of this UN compound because it was the only place they felt safe during this fighting.
Jason, we read of the most horrendous kind of fighting and violence there, torched villages, macheted babies, child warriors, cannibalism. Why is it so ugly? Why is it so down and dirty?
It's so down and dirty because there really is no law there. Rebel warlords are essentially operating at will, and their soldiers are unpaid. They tend to be teenage boys, sometimes younger than teenage boys. They're not well-trained, these soldiers. They're not paid by anyone. So the only way that they get food, even, is to pillage. They've started raping with impunity simply because they can. That is really why we're seeing such atrocities. And on top of that, a lot of these soldiers are either drunk or they're high on drugs. The French troops that came in, the first people that they killed were two militiamen who they said were extremely intoxicated and turned their weapons on the French troops, and the French killed them quite quickly.
Drunk and armed. Jason, we know that over the years of this domestic conflict, there have been a lot of foreign forces involved, Ugandan, Rwandan, Zimbabwean, and others earlier. At this point, are there foreign troops who are part of the conflict in eastern, northeastern Congo, or is it all local rebel units, surrogates for foreign interests? What's the stew there?
Officially, all of the foreign troops have pulled out, and I think for the most part that is true. I think there may still be some involvement of the Rwandans. There have been reports of that. The Rwandans deny it. But all of these groups are operating in an area that is very rich in mineral resources, gold mines, diamond mines, coltan mines, timber that's quite lucrative. And they've been backed in the past by foreign governments, by foreign armies, by other people with interest in controlling those resources. And simply because there was a peace deal signed in April which pulled those armies out, the weapons had already been shipped in, the munitions had already been shipped in, and it's a very lawless place. And I think that if people had monetary interests there and they could continue them, I think they would. On the surface, officially, everyone is out, but obviously there's money flowing in there from elsewhere because these rebels are getting weapons, they're getting more ammunition. I think that there's definitely connections to the outside world.
So foreign troops officially out, but foreign armies and interests continue to be tapped into those mineral and other resources, and the dying and death go on. What's the UN done so far, and what is being contemplated for a United Nations intervention here, Jason?
It should be noted that in Bunia, where about 500 people died, that's including fighters, but also a lot of civilians in the last 6-7 weeks, 500 people dead, a lot of those deaths could have been prevented by a UN force, and there was a UN force in town. There was a contingent of 700 Uruguayan troops on the ground, but they didn't have a mandate to protect civilians.
So what were they there for?
They were there as part of the UN's peacekeeping mission to the Congo, but they had such a weak mandate that they weren't able to go out and engage these fighters who were openly conducting battles in the streets of Bunia and terrifying civilians.
So the UN was there, but cowering in its compound, no mandate to go out and do real peacekeeping. Is that going to change? Is there anything in the pipeline that would send more UN forces in there somehow? Is it possible that the UN could actually pacify this area, or is that just beyond its capacity?
Well, the UN switched tracks. The Security Council gave a mandate for a French-led force to come in of 1,400 troops. They came in very quickly, straightened out the town. Today actually was a deadline that the French had set that no arms could be out on the streets. And before that, you had child soldiers just marching up and down the streets with AK-47s and driving around in pickup trucks with machine guns mounted on the top of them. And the French came in, and they quite quickly cleaned that up. And it shows what they're capable of doing. However, the French force that's there at the moment is only given a mandate to control Bunia and control the airport. And this is in a very vast swath of eastern Congo. Congo as a country is about the size of Western Europe.
This is one town in one corner of the Congo.
That's right. That's right. At the moment, the UN is considering its entire mandate for its mission in the Congo. And that mandate actually expires at the end of this month. I think there certainly will be something different that comes out of those discussions in New York at the UN. The U.S. has been somewhat skeptical about whether any of these changes are really going to change the situation on the ground without something different happening politically in eastern Congo to bring about peace. So they've been reluctant to up the number of troops or to change the mandate overall if it isn't going to have any effect. But a lot of the other members of the Security Council have really been pushing to increase the number of troops that are on the ground and to give them a more aggressive mandate to really engage some of these combatants.
Jason, do people in Congo think that the United Nations comes in, it can make a difference? It could end this seemingly endless, bloody fighting.
Many of the people that I talk to are really looking to the outside world to come in as their savior. I mean, people are being displaced by the hundreds of thousands. And as they're displaced from an agricultural economy, a very basic agricultural economy, they lose their access to food. Their gardens, the land around them is how they survive. And when they get pushed off somewhere else, their children are malnourished. I saw these children that are, you know, they look like those images that we had out of Ethiopia during the drought there. And this is in a rich country with bananas hanging on the trees and lush green all around you. Anything will grow there. Yet the people aren't able to eat because they've been forced to flee hundreds and hundreds of miles. They no longer believe that Kinshasa, the central government in Congo, is going to solve their problem. And they also don't believe that one of the rebel forces in eastern Congo is going to become strong enough to solidify control there and impose some law and some order and some security. People keep talking about the insecurity, and they're hoping that that will come from the outside world. It'll come from the UN. Some people hope that it'll come from the U.S.
Jason Beaubien is Africa correspondent for NPR News. He spoke with us from Kampala, Uganda. The United Nations, still smarting from its failure to heed warnings of the 1994 Rwandan genocide, is looking to slow the pace of killing in Congo. Kofi Annan asked the UN Security Council to triple the current number of military and logistical personnel in the region. But is that enough? As Congo's death toll swells, so does a desperate refugee population uprooted by fear and starvation, even in a land of low-hanging fruit. Should the United Nations, should the United States send a major peacekeeping force into Congo? Is the world sitting by while a slow motion Rwanda unfolds oceans away? When you hear about the slaughter, child soldiers, rape, and cannibalism, do you want to dig in or turn your back? What is possible here, and what is the world's responsibility? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Philip Gurevich, staff writer for The New Yorker and author of We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed with Our Family Stories from Rwanda. He's written about the region since 1995 and has been awarded the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and the Overseas Press Club Book Award. His novel, A Cold Case, is now being adapted for film by Tom Hanks. Good evening and welcome, Philip Gurevich.
Hello.
Good evening. Thank you for joining us. Philip, I wish you'd be good enough to give us a real thumbnail sketch of the history here. We want to get into what the UN, what the world might do now, but I think it's widely not understood. So much of what's going on today in Congo goes back to the infamous genocide in Rwanda. Can you draw the string between these two for us?
Well, Eastern Congo, which is the area we're talking about, is a border area with much of its border runs along the Rwandan border, and then part of it along the border with Uganda. Mm-hmm. Following the slaughter in Rwanda in 1994, when the government of Rwanda at the time in the spring and early summer of 1994 sort of orchestrated the massacre of 800,000 of its civilians, that government, the government of the Hutu majority that had orchestrated the genocide and many of its military and militia, fled along with a large number of civilians as what were then perceived as refugees, although many of them weren't refugees, they were actually fugitive war criminals, mostly into this eastern Congo area.
And after the massacre, kind of chased out by the Tutsis who came in to rescue their brother and from the genocide.
That's right. I mean, they came in for a number of reasons, but they seized control of the country, mm-hmm. and a new post-genocide regime that was predominantly composed of Tutsis who were coming in from exile. And this genocide, the group that basically, because they speak French around there, are called the genociders, mm-hmm. Which is actually a useful word we lack in English, it basically settled along the border of Rwanda, but in Congo, which, of course, remember, was then under the rule of Mobutu Sese Seko, the mm-hmm. sort of infamous dictator, and was called Zaire. Mm-hmm. So probably many people who are listening would remember having heard at the time about the Rwandans in the refugee camps in Zaire and how there were more than a million of them.
In Goma and all the way down the border.
Goma and Bukavu. Goma mm-hmm. became the epicenter of this catastrophe of these people. And although they were perceived as refugees and in themselves deserving of humanitarian aid, they were also a sort of rump Rwandan genocidal state where the militias and military of this completely war criminal regime were regrouping and rearming and retraining with the idea of completing the slaughter that they had abandoned when they fled.
Of going back into Rwanda to complete that slaughter. We're coming up on a break here, but I just want to get to the Rwandans would not sit by for this, as I understand it.
That's right. Ultimately, these camps were disbanded because they were threatening Rwanda on such an impossible scale, and there was no other solution. At that point, the Rwandans went in to Zaire, Congo, and the wars that began, the wars that we're seeing now, began in late 96 with the invasion of Congo by Rwanda to disband these groups and chase them into the interior and hunt them down.
Mobutu Sese Seko ended up out. Rwandan troops ended up powerful in the Congo. So did Ugandan troops. They later split. Seems for a time almost all of Africa had troops of one kind or presence of one kind or another. There are nearly nine countries. And now we've got the aftermath of that. Philip Gurevich, stand by. We have to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about life and death in Congo, about Africa's endless war and the world's responsibility there. Should the United Nations, should the United States send a major peacekeeping force into Congo? Is the world tolerating a slow-motion repeat of the Rwandan genocide here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about life and death in Congo, about Africa's endless war and the world's responsibility there. When you hear about slaughter, child soldiers, cannibalism, do you want to dive in or to turn your back? If your cell phone runs on minerals from bloody Congo, do you have a responsibility to stand up for peace there? Or is this primarily the problem of the Congolese and of Africa? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is Philip Gurevich, staff writer for The New Yorker and longtime watcher of Central Africa, Rwanda, the conflict in Congo. Philip, you were just taking us through the history here, the kind of roots of this and the Rwandan genocide in Rwanda's pushback when they felt that the Hutus sitting as refugees on the other side of the border in Congo would still menace them. They eventually kicked out Mobutu Sese Seko and ended up becoming this tiny Rwanda neighbor, a major power in Africa's largest country.
Yes, not Rwanda alone, I should say. Militarily, Rwanda was probably the most significant force, but they allied themselves very carefully with a variety of Congolese political actors who had interests also in overthrowing Mobutu Sese Seko and taking power, which ultimately meant the installation of President Laurent Kabila, who was a great disaster, and who was later assassinated. He's been replaced by his son. That's when people speak of the regime in Kinshasa, the government in Kinshasa. Under Mobutu Sese Seko, the one thing that he did successfully, albeit heavy-handedly, was to create a sense of national unity out of this very vast territory, the size, as Jason Bobian said, of Western Europe. The whole war that one saw there, the fact that you had nine countries coming in, allying themselves with a host of rebel groups and so forth, is indicative of the fact that although Congo beneath its soil is famous for having a good deal of riches, it's a country that suffered from indescribable weakness. I mean, there was no infrastructure. One of the reasons that so much of eastern Congo is ungoverned by the central government is that it simply isn't reachable from there by road.
It's rivers or airplanes or nothing.
The rivers are cut when somebody controls one end of the river and somebody else controls the other. You can't get, you know, from one port to the other. So rivers are no longer carrying traffic. At this point, the only way to get around is on foot, which requires a fairly intrepid army, or by air for the most part, or locally. So you have these local sort of fragmented areas, some of which function internally reasonably well, and some of which, as we're seeing in the area of Ituri, where Bunia and the current catastrophe is taking place, are totally fragmented and being sort of torn apart by rival groups whose interests are extremely limited and difficult to describe as even political.
And so for a time, Congo was described as the setting for Africa's first world war. There were so many African countries involved. At this point, most of the foreign troops are out of Congo, but the fighting goes on. What are the puppet strings here, Philip Gurevich?
Well, I think it's important to understand that the fighting that we see now is not the result of the major war, but it's the result of the peace. The peace required that these foreign armies leave. The foreign armies were the largest powers in what was essentially a place whose attraction was, as I say, a power vacuum. Mm-hmm. In a power vacuum, all these people kind of were sucked in or went in with little resistance. As they were there, they caused an enormous amount of suffering, but they also created systems of control. As they leave, they recreate the power vacuum. And in their place, they leave, as in the case of this Ituri region of the northeast, which is getting attention right now, they leave a number of small local militias, rebel groups, warlords, and small interests, many of which they themselves armed, equipped, and sort of deployed as proxies. In the stuff we're seeing now in Bunia, as Jason Bobian was describing, there are two militia groups. Well, both of those were essentially armed and set upon each other by the Ugandan army, the same army. Now that it's left, they immediately started fighting, which was long predicted, trying to see who could gain control of what was left. And so you have a situation where trying to look for a larger solution that would in fact knit together interests and create some kind of a social fabric is the bigger challenge, even if one were able in piecemeal way to staunch some of the killing.
Philip Gurevich, you've painted the mural for us. I want to invite to join us now Adam Hochschild. He's joining us from Turner, Maine. He's the author of King Leopold's Ghost, the story of the early Belgian inroads into Central Africa. He's a lecturer at the Graduate School of Journalism at Berkeley. He's currently working on a book about the early anti-slavery movement. Good evening and welcome, Adam Hochschild.
Hi, Tom, and hello, Philip.
Thanks so much for joining us. Adam Hochschild, you've written about the material interests, the material resources that keep everybody's hand in Congo one way or another, above the table or below. Describe that skein of resources that has everyone so fixated and involved there.
Well, you often hear Congolese say, we wouldn't have so much trouble if we weren't such a rich country. And that has been so in different forms for hundreds of years.
But Jason Bobian was describing this hand-to-mouth as a subsistence farming at best life.
Well, that's true for people living there, but I'm talking about what the outside world has perceived there. And really, if you go back hundreds of years, the riches that were perceived in this area were slaves. The territory was raided from the west coast of Africa by the Atlantic slave, people who supplied the Atlantic slave trade. It was raided from the east coast by the people who supplied the slave trade to the Arab world, and these folks came hundreds of miles into the interior rounding up slaves. Then the period that I wrote about in my book, the big resource that Europeans were after at the beginning was ivory. Elephant tusks, tremendously valued in Europe and the United States at that time.
And this is the Joseph Conrad Heart of Darkness period.
Exactly. Anybody who's read Heart of Darkness knows the lust for ivory, the sense of a gold rush around this precious commodity that Conrad captured so extraordinarily in that book. Then, very soon after that, came a gold rush for something else, namely rubber. As soon as they invented the inflatable bicycle tire in the late 1880s, which was followed very quickly by the invention of the automobile, this set off a worldwide rubber boom, and people in Europe and North America could not get enough of this magical stuff. All over the world, in the tropics, people planted rubber plantations, but a rubber plantation, it takes a seedling up to 15 years to grow to maturity and become a rubber tree that you can tap rubber out of. And those who could really make money during that interim period, which was about 1895 to 1910, were anybody who had land where rubber grew wild. And the great equatorial African rainforest that covers about half of the Congo was very, very rich in wild rubber.
But the rubber boom is a century behind us now. What's in Congo now that's attracting interest, and what kind of interest? Who's taking what out of the country? How does that intersect with what's going on with this fighting?
Okay, the principal commodities now are coltan, which you mentioned, this mineral which is used in computer chips, cell phones, other electronic devices, gold, diamonds. There are some places in the Northeast where they believe there is oil, there's copper, there's uranium,
And is all this stuff flowing out despite the fighting, despite the bloodshed?
There is, because, you know, a lot of this thing, you know, the gold and so on, these are very small-scale mining operations, and they can continue in the midst of civil war. And in fact, for the companies that are buying this stuff, in some cases it's to their advantage to do this business during civil war, because then the amount of taxes you have to pay are less and you don't have to worry about environmental regulations.
So even without a government, the resources are flowing out. Philip Gravitch, you've written that the ultimate sort of horror of the Congo may be that the world pays no price for ignoring the killing there. Is that because, as Adam Hochschild describes, the resources flow? Why bother?
Well, I think that when we talk about the riches, it's very crucial what he just said, which is that the small scaleness of these operations.
Mm-hmm.
If when Mobutu Sese Seko fell in 1997, I went into Kinshasa about a week later, and at the big hotels in town, there were all these Belgian mineral guys who had been there in the good old days of the big boom mines of the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. There were all kinds of mining interests from all over the world. And after about a week or two, you'd sort of see them sitting around the lobby shaking their heads and looking totally discouraged. And you said, what's up? And they said, you know, the condition of the mines in this country, the industrial scale major mines that you could invest a lot of money in and get a lot of money out of, is hopeless. It's so bad. And the cobalt mines and the copper mines in particular, and even some of the diamond mining, that for any serious outside investment to invest in this with the infrastructure, you'd have to build so much and you'd have to put so much in that with the instability here, it's not worth it.
But that would suggest that beyond a humanitarian concern, there is a potential resource interest that the rest of the world might have if you want to look at it in very cold terms. So why isn't the world going in strength to help bring peace to Congo?
Because what I'm trying to say is that I think that Congo is rich enough to pay for war, but it may not be rich enough to pay for peace. It's rich enough that countries like Rwanda that went in with a real security interest, its military and its the businessmen allied with its military started to acquire financial interests. The country is rich enough to pay for an army to pay for itself while it's in there. And by extracting these things, by taking these things out, when you go to see the diamond dealers in a place like Kisangani in the midst of this war, as I did a few years ago, they're dealing with guys who come up with tiny little pieces of folded paper and show you a raw stone, barely bigger than you see on a sort of average engagement ring. Mm-hmm. This is not airplane loads of jewels going out this way or that. And so it's small enough to fuel that. But the scale of the political problem that would be required to solve in order to create the stability that would be required for the investment you're talking about, for the world, for the kind of investment that makes people get interested in Iraq as a place that could afford its own reconstruction, as we've heard argued.
Yes.
That's just not the picture in Congo at this stage.
But Adam Hochschild, could it not be, if there were peace for some extended period there, couldn't Congo be rich on that scale, rich enough to have its own government, its own state, or is this not a country that's ever going to work?
Well, I think Philip is right to make the comparison to Iraq, and part of it has to do with what the nature of these riches are, because you look at Iraq, where the wealth is in oil, one of the things about a developed oil industry is that it takes a vast network of stuff to make it work. It takes huge refineries, it takes pipelines, and so forth, and you can really only get the oil out if you've got an army that controls the whole country enough to prevent people from blowing up tanker terminals and pipelines. The U.S. is having a hard time doing it
right
with
now.
150,000 soldiers now, and it may well take more. But when the riches flow, even in the midst of war, as do, you know, diamonds and small-scale gold mining and so forth, the outside world doesn't have the incentive to risk a lot of money and a lot of lives to make the place more stable. And I think Philip put his finger on it in a piece he did in the New Yorker a couple of weeks ago, that the great tragedy of this place is that there isn't a cost to the outside world if this terrible bloodletting continues. And I fear that that is the case. And the only force that I can see that might motivate the outside world, meaning primarily Europe and the United States, to make the kind of intervention I think would be necessary to slow down the killings, is a sense of shame that we would have this blood on our hands yet again, as we really did in the case of Rwanda.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mary's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
Fine.
I would just like to say, Philip, my book club read your book less than a month ago, and it came to us through a young girl who had to read it for college, but we all read it, and I was amazed because I'm going to be 40 years old, and I thought, I was alive during this time. I heard this stuff. You know, why wasn't this important to me then? And as I was reading your book, I was just absolutely appalled that of all the things that you told us about, you know, America and how we, you know, we sent aid over there. And I think you even said that Bill Clinton was in the airport at one point and then they wouldn't let him go into the country. What the hell is going on here? Why don't we know about this stuff? And why are we letting it happen? It's driving me crazy.
Mary, is it your sense that you would like to see UN, U.S. intervention in Congo, given what you've heard, given what we know?
I would like to see the world intervene in what's going in on the Congo. This is just, you know, and you know, I listen every day to the radio, and I hear that this stuff is going on, and I think, why isn't anyone doing anything about this?
Mary, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Philip Gravich, there's a reader and someone who says, hey, we read your story of what happened in Rwanda. Let's not let it happen, even in slow motion, in Congo. Do we make that parallel too easily, or is it a realistic parallel? Do you see a kind of, Adam Hochschild uses the word shame, blood on the world's hands. Is that what's going on here? Should the world be ashamed? Should it feel morally compelled to be in Congo?
I think one may feel shame without necessarily in any kind of politically realistic way, expecting the risk of life and treasure by the world community there. Rwanda, sadly, presented a somewhat more orderly and coherent case. You had in Rwanda the opposite of political disorder. You had an enormously organized, centralized government that was able to mobilize its people to carry out a series of massacres. And part of that made both it implementable, but it also made it preventable. When people argue about the ways that Rwanda might have been stopped, the killings there, part of the idea is that you actually had responsible pyramid of power, and you had steady contacts between those leaders who were carrying out the slaughter and governments both in France and in Washington and so forth, who had influence at times over them and who failed to use it. We had a UN force there that understood these things, and it was basically, at America's behest, withdrawn from doing anything. In Congo, you know, we're talking now about what can the UN do in this one itty-bitty town, which, frankly, it's
Bunia.
I don't know what to compare it to. It's the size of Meriden, Connecticut. It's a very small place.
A provincial outpost.
It's a small place. It is not Congo. It is a dot in Congo. Mm-hmm. And they don't even have a mandate. This robust French force we're being asked to have hope for doesn't even have a mandate to leave the limits of the town. So many of the people, as they pacify the town, all that means is that they send the killers to the outskirts. And woe to those who are in the outskirts. Now, the question of how these things happen and we do or don't know about them and, you know, how does the world's shame work? Adam Hochschild made the point, and I thought it was an excellent point, that you know, how does the world's shame work? Well, in the old days, in the period that he wrote his spectacular book about, part of what mobilized people to be upset about what was happening in Congo was the fact that there was no ambiguity about how the Western world was profiting from it. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it was the anti-slave movement, the question was, we were buying the slaves. The rubber movement, we were buying the rubber.
Right.
Those human rights movements could make that claim. You could even make that claim about the way that Mobutu Sese Seko abused that country because he was so propped up by us and by other Western powers. At this point, sadly, disengagement breeds greater disengagement. The moral case is harder to argue when it happens in a vacuum of American interests. It's not harder to argue as humanity, but to find the lever where you connect the argument that humanity is being crushed in Congo and find the lever by which that moves us to take action as people who aren't neighbors but far away is very difficult to find.
We have to take a short break. We'll come back and look at that with Philip Gurevich and Adam Hochschild. We're talking tonight about life and death in Congo, Africa's endless war, and the world's responsibility there. Should the United Nations send a major peacekeeping force into Congo? When you hear about slaughter, child soldiers, cannibalism, do you want to dive in or turn your back? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about life and death in Congo, about Africa's endless war there, and the world's responsibility. The question for you, should the United Nations, the United States, send a major peacekeeping force into the Congo to bring peace? Could it bring peace? Can the colonial legacy still be blamed for what's going on in Congo? Or is this a thoroughly modern resource grab? And where do you find hope for Congo? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Philip Gurevich, staff writer at The New Yorker, author of We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, and Adam Hochschild, joining us from Turner, Maine tonight, author of King Leopold's Ghost. You can join the conversation as well. George is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, George. You're on the air.
How you doing? Thank you. Great. Yeah, I've heard the economic argument made, and I think that's unsatisfactory. I think that as moral agents, we are responsible for supporting humanity. And when, as a civilization, we take the temperature of or measure our humanity, we always do it at the lowest level of our society, not at the top. Mm-hmm. And I think what we've seen a new nadir present with the conflict in the Congo, and I think we as a society, as a world, need to measure that and look at that as indicative of our overall humanity. And I think that's the lever that needs to be pulled, and people need to be aware, and not so much an economic argument. But,
so you're prepared to see what the world does with Congo as a kind of litmus test of global humanity. Let's put that to our guests, and thanks for your call, George. Adam Hochschild, let me put it to you. We heard from Philip a bit about this just before the break. I've spent some time in Rwanda and Congo, seen how bad things can be there. And I've heard in the last months, people hearing these reports coming out of Congo so gruesome and just holding their heads in their hands and saying, what is happening? What's going on with this world? What does that add up to you personally? Does it add up to an obligation to go in there, and does that intersect with any kind of real politique that's going to take the world in there as a peacekeeping mission?
Well, I think the problem is that it doesn't intersect with much of a real politique, but I think there is an obligation. When people are killing each other in such huge numbers, and we have to remember that the going estimate by the International Rescue Committee is that a minimum of 3.3 million people have died in the last 6 years as a result of this war. Now, this is not all people, killed by bullets, but people, starving to death because they're in flight as refugees and they're forced into areas where they can get no food and so forth. But that's half a Holocaust there. That's a lot of people. And I feel there is a responsibility to do something. I think we should have no illusions that even in the best of circumstances, if the UN force were quadrupled and there were, 40,000 soldiers there, that it would solve everything and set the country or even a part of the country on the road to, stable democratic self-government. That's not going to happen. But it could dramatically slow down these enormous killings, and I think that would be a good thing.
But what about Philip Gravitch's argument that the world is too disengaged from the resources and issues in Congo to have a practical interest in it? Like the point you made yourself, it's not just turning a switch on the oil pipelines here. There's disengagement breeds disengagement, that it's simply not going to happen. What do you think, Adam Hochschild?
Well, I think if you look back through history, you do find cases where even when people were acting against their own economic self-interest, people did get engaged and did, especially when there was a campaign over many years' time, force their governments to act in ways that did save lives and did bring some of the inhumanity that man does to man to an end. One thing I'm thinking of, for example, is the end of slavery in the British Empire, which happens to be something I'm just finishing a book about right now. Mm-hmm. It took 50 years of organizing to bring this about, but slavery ended in the British Empire a good quarter century before it did in the United States, and it was totally against Britain's economic self-interest to do this. By modern economists' calculations, it cost them 1-2% of their gross national product each year and lost, income from the labor of the slaves. Mm. Nobody in the movement made a penny out of it. Left a lot of people with interests in slave plantations and slave ships and so forth very upset.
And yet they did it. On the other hand, there was a huge abolition movement. There's hardly a huge Save Congo movement that we hear.
That's right. But, there were moments when the abolition movement was deeply discouraged and disappeared. There have been moments in recent years, especially, I think, around the intervention which did finally belatedly happen in the Balkans, when there really were people, more in Europe than the United States, who were out organizing, demanding this. I don't expect that to happen immediately in regard to Congo, but I hope that there is a constituency out there for pushing the United Nations to act in cases like this.
Philip Gravitch, you've explored this terrain, the kind of meeting of Holocaust or genocide and global sensibilities. Do you think intervention will happen? And if it doesn't, what does that mean for, our caller said this has to do with kind of the health of the global soul. How do you interpret what it means if millions can die in Congo and the world never goes in?
I think that's a very good question. It's one that I've been wondering about a great deal lately because I don't anticipate any kind of very large-scale intervention. And when I say that, I would say a large-scale intervention that is likely to be very satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
Because the example of the Balkans aside, one should remember that a great number of the problems that we're talking about in the Congo are not just to be solved by intervention, but are the problem of outside intervention. The idea that the world gets involved does not always mean that the world solves the problem.
That's for sure.
And we need to keep that in mind, because quite often there's this idea that we're going, that like, why doesn't somebody do something? And that presumes that we will do the right thing and we will do it well and we will get out when we've done it and it will stay done. And that is, I'm afraid, a naive assumption. Obviously.
But when millions die and we hear about it day in and day out, month in and month out, cannibalism, the works, that's terrible for Congo. It can't be.
It's terrible for the world's conscience. What I'm wondering about is, what does it mean to watch a large swath of an entire continent go very steadily deeper into hell while we prosper?
Yeah.
Now, this may not be, as one might wish, as linked. In other words, our prosperity may not be directly linked to their lack of prosperity.
I mean, it may make no difference to the United States.
Our forkful may not be a forkful out of their mouth. When Adam Hochschild talks about the compelling example of slavery, one of the things is slaves were in our society. Mm-hmm. Trying to convince people what the connection is harder, which means it's harder to mobilize people for exactly the sort of movement of conscience that he's describing, which I would love to see. But I do believe that it's not just Congo. Let's remember that while this is happening in Congo, there are wars in Ivory Coast. There are war. The Sudan, which you haven't heard from in a while, has not gotten any better since you last heard. It's catastrophic, and the death tolls are huge. Mm. You have people dying in enormous numbers in a well-governed country like South Africa because the government is standing in the way of their being treated for AIDS. In Zimbabwe, you have a dictatorship that is presiding over the destruction of a good economy and the deaths of large numbers of people from starvation and brutality. This is continent-wide, you have serious problems which have to be looked at to some extent very, very locally. And at the same time, one can't help being overwhelmed by their sort of coincidence. And I think in people's minds, that's part of the problem. So the question you ask, what does it mean for us to be standing by, seems to me to be the question one has to ask in order to come up against what's really happening.
The moral consequence.
Something vast is going wrong in humanity, in a large swath of humanity.
Philip, I want to get one more call here. Nick is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Nick, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. How are you gentlemen doing tonight? It's a great topic that you're bringing up for discussion right now, and a lot of emphasis and inner interest needs to be put on it. I've got some experience over in that region. I spent about 7 months with a security force over in Sierra Leone in 99 and 2000, and your guest just brought up a great point. It's not limited to only one region in that part of the world.
Nick, our time is short. From your experience, if the UN intervenes, can it help the situation?
No, the last thing I want to see intervention. I want to see direct intervention, but I do not want to see a United Nations force go in there. They do not work. I've seen it in Somalia. I served with it in Sri Lanka, the Balkans, including Sierra Leone, and they do not.
So, what kind of intervention then, Nick? What kind of intervention?
It needs to be direct action by one country taking a direct role in it. It needs to be a unified command. That's why the United Nations security forces do not work.
Nick, we've got it. I'm going to have to let it go there. Adam Hochschild, what's your word? And we're coming down to the end of our time here. Will it happen? Can it happen? And if it doesn't, to Philip's point, what is the moral consequence?
Well, let me just throw in a couple of other things which we haven't mentioned, which I think would be modest contributions that the outside world could do. One thing that would be helpful, I think, although it's not going to solve the problem, is if the United States would stop pouring arms into Africa. The U.S. has spent more than $200 million since 1990 in arming African countries south of the Sahara, and at least six of the countries that we've given military aid to have had troops engaged in the Congo Civil War. I don't think that's been helpful. I think it would be very helpful if we stopped. Second thing I should mention is that we now have an agreement, an international agreement, which the U.S. has signed, amazingly, not to trade in what's called conflict diamonds, which come from some of these civil wars in Africa.
Well, Adam Hochschild, with that, we're going to have to let it go. I'm afraid we're out of time, but we've got it. Watch out for those other minerals. Adam Hochschild, author of King Leopold's Ghost, an upcoming book on the early anti-slavery movement. Thank you for being with us tonight. And Philip Gurevich, staff writer at The New Yorker. Thank you as well. It's been great having you. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. This is On Point. Leon Uris, master of the historical blockbuster, died last weekend at his home in Shelter Island, New York. He was 78. His death was announced by his ex-wife, photographer Jill Uris, earlier today. Leon Uris was perhaps best known for his novel Exodus, a 1958 account of the creation of the State of Israel. That novel and the Paul Newman movie adapted from it helped to shape many Americans' views on the Jewish state. All told, Uris's novels, including Exodus, Trinity, Battle Cry, and others, have sold over 150 million copies in 29 countries. On Point News analyst Jack Beatty still recalls the first time he read Exodus back in 1960. He remembers Leon Uris tonight with a reading from Uris's first novel, Battle Cry. In this scene, the narrator, a Marine sergeant named Mac, is escorting a wounded young soldier named Danny back home on a train to Baltimore, Uris's birth city. The two have just finished in service in the Pacific during World War II.
I looked through the rain-streaked window and caught a fleeting glimpse of a wide lawn street with a set of huge buildings. It must have been Johns Hopkins Hospital. Then the train plunged into a long tunnel. Baltimore! There'll be a 10-minute stopover! I nudged the sleeping boy sitting beside me. Wake up, Danny, you're home. He opened his eyes and stood. I helped him square away his field scarf and button his blouse. How do I look? Like a doll. The train lurched as it braked to a stop. I caught him to prevent his falling. Danny winced. Hurt? I asked. Nah. How's the old flipper feel? He grinned. It won't be much good for tossing 50-yard passes. They told me they'd be pulling shrapnel out of my back for 10 years. The train halted. I pulled Danny's gear from the luggage rack and edged to the door. We stepped from the train. I gave the bags to a porter and handed him a bill. Sure you won't stay a couple of days, Mac? Nah, you don't want me around. I gotta get to New York and see Levin's dad and get on back to the coast. Not much time left. A crowd surged past us to fight onto the already crowded train. Behind us, a gang of kids stood with their handbags. A Marine recruiting sergeant in dress blues paced up and down. You have 5 minutes, he barked. Voices rose behind Danny and me. Take care of yourself, son. Get a jab for me, will you? Right. Now, don't worry, Mom. Everything is going to be all right. They're putting us in a place called boot camp for a couple of weeks. You'll be sorry, a uniformed Marine sang as he passed them. Danny and I embraced clumsily. So long, you salty old son of a bitch. So long, Jirene. Danny turned and pushed his way down the platform to the foot of the stairs. I followed, several paces behind. A news vendor shouted his headline, Marines take Suribachi on Iwo Jima. Get your latest news post in Sun. Marines on Iwo Jima. I caught a glimpse of the front page he waved. They were raising the flag on the mountaintop in the picture. Danny fought step by step up the long stairs. Then he stopped and looked up. She was there. Surely she's the angel I pictured for him. Danny! She shouted over the din. Kathy! Kathy! And they fought through the mass of hurrying people into each other's arms. I saw them move to the top of the steps. An older man was there and a boy. Danny took off his cap and reached for the man's hand. I could see his lips move. Hello, Dad. I'm home.
On Point News analyst Jack Beatty reading from Leon Uris's first novel, Battle Cry. Uris died over the weekend. He was 78. His final novel, O'Hara's Choice, is slated for publication in October. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.